So the little saying that I'd like to offer in the start of this talk that perhaps can be seen as kind of a core instruction or core guidelines or core direction where we're heading in through this practice. And that's the saying, trust awareness and love everyone. Those two things. If you do those two things, it's going to be pretty good. Trust awareness, trust your awareness, trust awareness and love everyone. There was a story from the time of the Buddha of a bunch of well-to-do young people, noble men and women, who went to frolic in the park one day. And it happened to be that on some edge of the park, the Buddha was quietly meditating under a tree by himself. But in the part of the park where they were at, they were frolicking and doing what they do. And at some point, they had a picnic, and at some point, they all took afternoon naps. And they had an attendant with them. But she didn't nap. While everybody else was napping, she went around and took all of their jewelry. So when they woke up, they were all the these jewels, they were wealthy, right? So all the jewels were gone. And so they kind of started running through the park and they looking for her, because she was disappeared, so they figured maybe she'd do something about it. And so they came running past the Buddha. And they asked the Buddha, "Have you seen an attendant?" And the Buddha said, "What would you rather find? An attendant or yourself?" They stopped, sat down to hear what he had to say, and he taught them. So the idea of finding ourselves, stopping, and you guys stopped for now 6 days in order to be present. And I'm pretty confident that each one of you knows yourself better from having stopped and been present and been mindful, checking in, finding out what's going on here. It's a wonderful thing to discover oneself. If we don't discover ourselves, we don't find ourselves, then there's all these unconscious forces that can operate inside of us, subconscious forces that drive us and run us and influence how we see the world, how we live in the world, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to others. And so to find ourselves doesn't mean to find the metaphysical self, doesn't mean like my true identity or something. It just is a colloquial way of saying just get to know what's going on, your particular real estate. You know, because no one else can really get to know yourself as well as you can. It's where you have some impact. It's where you have some influence. It's where you have probably the biggest kind of biggest person, the most important person who can make a difference for you is yourself, by really getting to know yourself here. And we know it's not an easy process, but in the process of doing it, we learn a lot. And we learn a lot from our suffering. We learn a lot about how we are closed or resist or tight or afraid or, you know. So there's this wonderful, and then we come to a time when we realize it doesn't, you know, it hurts. We limit ourselves by what we attach to, what we cling to, the identities that we're trying to either hold on to or the identities we're trying to repel and not pretend we're not that. So when we start feeling the cost of that, start feeling the cost of some of our things we're attached to and the emotions we're caught in, then at some point we feel it seems more interesting to open up and let go than it is to continue with business as usual. And so there's a wonderful quote by Anandin. And the day came when the risk to remain tight in a bud was more painful than the risk to blossom. So you can stay, you know, tight, contained, attached for a long time. But at some point we can feel a sense that this is not worth it anymore. This is the risk, the cost is too great. And I don't know what it's like to open those risks, but they have to be less than how I'm living. And so then to open, to blossom. Remember I held up the flower the other day. And so for you to blossom into the flower that you're supposed to be. And each of you will be a different kind of flower. So it almost doesn't make sense to compare yourself to other people, because it doesn't make sense to compare the rose to the violet, or the, you know, by itself it's just a beautiful thing. So to blossom into who you are, that's always going to be unique. Your gift to the world. And that's what the Buddha did. The Buddha woke up. He blossomed. He became awake. And here's a wonderful little poem by Mary Oliver about the Buddha's last period as he was dying, last day perhaps. And this poem has a lot of, as I read it, if you want to follow it a little bit, there's a lot of light images in it. So you might just be a little bit kind of sensitive to the imagery that has to do with light and how it plays through the poem. And the poem is called The Buddha's Last Instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between the two sala trees. He might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields around him. Over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs, disattached in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt, he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers of fire. Clearly, I'm not needed. Yet, I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd. Looking into the faces of the frightened crowd, he said, make of yourself a light. So we live in a world of fear. And the Buddha said, in this world where we're frightened, so easily frightened, make yourself a light. There's a saying that it's better to light a candle than to curse in the darkness. It's better to light a candle than curse in the darkness. And the darker the times become, the more important it is for us to light our candles. And the candle is not, you know, something that we keep in a cupboard or a drawer and bring out, but rather it's in our hearts, it's within us. What is it that we can turn on? What is it we can light and shine? And it might seem that a candle is kind of a small light, but that's what we have. And that's what we can do. We can take our candle, the light that we have, make yourself a light. Make yourself a light for the world. Make yourself a light for yourself. Lighten up. Lighten the world. And so to be awake is to live in light. We call, you say, enlightenment. Be awake is to have some spark of clarity, of freedom, of compassion that arises out from within us and can radiate out, flow outwards. And the idea of it, something radiating from us from within and radiating out to the world, is a, I think, a very profound way of living. It's a very profound idea that we have that ability, that it's possible to be that way, as opposed to feel like we're a victim or feel like we're caught in the whirlpools of life or pushed around by the tides of life, the coming and goings of life, whatever's going on. But rather than feeling at sea and lost, to feel at home here in ourselves. So no matter where we go, maybe we don't have a real home to live in, but we have a home in our hearts. It radiates from us here. Make of yourself a light. William Stafford writes, "It is important for awake people to be awake. Or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep." It's important for awake people to be awake, to stay awake. Or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. We don't want people to shut down and go back to sleep. We don't want you to go back to sleep. So what does it take to stay awake? What does it take to stay aware? What does it take with whatever you've touched on this retreat, whatever sense of presence, connection, understanding, calm, peace, freedom, some intimation, some hint, some intuition of a different way of living that you've touched that is valuable for you? How can you let that flame, how can you let that candle continue to burn rather than for that part of you to go back to sleep? So that was nice. It was nice then, and you know, someday I hope to go back on retreat. You know, it's kind of, I think it's a little bit sad just to forget about this, let it kind of close up again. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's so helpful to have a second half of the retreat, that you kind of take your time. Be careful not to rush back headlong into the world that you're used to. It's not a sin to do that, but you kind of, it's too easy for parts of us to fall back asleep. So then the question is, what is it to be really awake? What is it to really have the light on? And I'm reluctant to answer that question for you. Maybe I can only answer it for myself. Because each of you, it will be your light. Your blossoming. Your flower. Your way of connecting to something that guides you, supports you, moves you, sustains you, opens you. Something that, you know, that, you know, and it has maybe your own words, your own sensibility about what that is. And I have a lot of respect for that movement of us for finding what's in us that can radiate, that's our own, what's ours. And it doesn't need to look like someone else's. It doesn't need to look like the Buddha's or anyone. It just, it might be very unique to you, the particular manifestation of what it's like to be awake, to have the light on. But to offer a few thoughts, about what it might mean, partly from my own experience of it, and also a little bit from the Buddhist tradition. It's to lose interest in clinging, to lose interest in being attached. It's just not so interesting anymore. It doesn't have any value. It's like it's more interesting to not cling than it is to cling. It's more interesting to be at ease than it is to be stressed out. It's more interesting to be peaceful than to throw yourself headlong into conflict. It's to lose interest in being moralistic, judgmental, needing to be right, needing to be special, losing interest in acquisitions, just acquiring things for the sake of acquiring, losing interest in being afraid, losing interest in being opposing, being oppositional, in arguing, in complaining. There's a powerful statement I heard once that if you go for refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, then you have no reason to ever again complain. What do you think of that? Lose interest in arguing. Lose interest in being alarmed. Losing interest in drawing hard lines between us versus them. And the first two, not being moralistic or judgmental, there's certainly a time and a place where we have to be discerning and make decisions and have some evaluation, some decisions around maybe other people's behavior. But when we don't have to, and we don't have a role in it, why should we? What does it matter to us? And I've seen that, you know, I've lost interest in really being moralistically judgmental of people because it lessens me. It hurts me to do that. I get kind of contracted and tight and my mind is kind of going, and oh, how could they, and they shouldn't do that, and whatever, you know, the things we do. But, I mean, why should I tie myself up in being judgmental and moralistic when I wasn't to begin with? You know, I mean, this poor person who did something terrible, and I'm helping the person do more terrible things by getting me all worked up and tight. You know, just, you know, leave, you know. If there's no need, I find it's just nice to stay open, present, and to meet the person. To meet the person with kindness, with love, with presence, with myself. And then if I need to be involved, then we can have a discussion. Then we can explore what needs to happen, or sometimes we need to kind of make, you know, strong decisions. But I suspect that it's only a small percentage of the times that people are judgmental or moralistically judgmental of each other. I suspect it's only a very small percentage of the time where it helps anybody. So this losing of interest, of all these forces and activities that kind of we do that cause us suffering. And in fact, there's a wonderful three verses from the Dhammapada that has a refrain. It says something like, seeing how all things are impermanent, one loses interest. in suffering. When the first time I saw that, I said, what? How could anybody be interested in suffering? But to lose interest in suffering, and there is a kind of a pull, a fascination, a commitment to suffering, or a preoccupation with our suffering that sometimes keeps it going and fuels it. And sometimes there's a very healthy kind of disinterest, like, oh, okay. You know, it's not such a big deal, or I just let it be and go on with my life. So to lose interest in things that are not helpful, I think is a very important part of this practice. And what would be helpful for you to lose interest in? Because you know well enough, that's enough. I've done that enough. I've got the lesson. What lessons would you like to have? And one of these, I think very important lessons has to do with victory and defeat. To live in a world of competition. Someone wins and someone loses. And the Buddha said, victory gives birth to hate. The defeated sleep tormented. Giving up both victory and defeat, the peaceful sleep delighted. And I think I could feel in myself, and I imagine a few of you, that the idea of giving up victory and defeat, I mean, what's the alternative? It just sounds like just defeat. Then, you know, it's over. You're like, how are you going to do anything if you can't fight back? And this idea of giving up victory and defeat, I mean, the Buddha, apparently this poem was written when he heard about two kingdoms. The kings went to war with each other. So, and that was the context for it. But still, I think it's very sad to live in a world where it's measured by victory and defeat. Like we have, I think it's very unfortunate this way that we have elections in this country where it's so dramatic, the sense of victory and defeat. And the ones who win, sometimes we'll just like forget about the people who defeated. We defeated, now we can do whatever we want. But this kind of losing interest I'm talking about is not a resignation. It's not an avoidance of responsibility. And it's not a denying of what's happening for us. Remember, the light's supposed to be on. We're supposed to be attentive and present for our life. And in fact, I think it's the opposite. That once we lose interest in these things that debilitate us, that drain us, that limit us, then we become able to see more clearly. We become more sensitive to what's happening. And so, for this back, I don't know why I'm emphasizing this today, but if we stop being kind of moralistically judgmental of people, but you know, first chance we have, but meet them without that filter, then it's possible to see them more deeply, to understand them, to connect to them. And there might be all kinds of depth, all kinds of aspects of who they are, that if you got to know, you kind of have a bigger picture of the person, a better understanding. So to lose interest in all these debilitating things is to develop a heightened sensitivity, heightened awareness to two things, to oneself and the unsatisfactoriness of hate, of hard divisions between people, of craving, of fixed identifications, of acquisitiveness, of distractions, of going asleep. Because it doesn't feel good anymore, it doesn't feel right. And there's a very healthy, in Buddhist practice, is very, you're not supposed to just kind of be skipping down the sidewalks, whistling happily all the time on a cloud. there's a kind of a deep kind of maturation or certain, even certain gravitas in this life. And this idea of being discovering things, that certain things are unsatisfying, not valuable, you don't value them anymore. So a heightened sensitivity to oneself, and then there's a heightened sensitivity to others. Because hopefully our hearts become more open. And the sensitivity to others is the sensitivity of an open heart. We sense and feel and have empathy and caring for other people. We receive them in our hearts. We sense them. We're not closed to all the, you know, the empathy that can come from being in contact with people and knowing what's happening. And so Buddhism, Buddhist practice itself is not meant to be a withdrawal from the world, as if the world doesn't count. Remember this slogan, you know, trust awareness and love everyone. Gary Snyder, who's a poet, studied Zen in Japan in the early 60s. And he learned when he was studying Zen from someone that in Zen there's only two things, two practices. And the first was to sit in meditation, and the second is to sweep the monastery courtyard. But don't think the courtyard stops at the gate. It's the whole world. So to meditate and then sweep. So I take that to mean trust awareness and then take care of the world you're in. Sit and practice. Centered on yourself, become free, become awake, light the candle, and then take your candle into the world. Sweep. Take care of what this world of ours. But if your candle is on, if you are awake, I believe that we won't be exhausted by our sweeping. We won't be overwhelmed by it. It just becomes an extension of who we are, rather than a duty, rather than an obligation that we kind of force ourselves to engage in, and it's never ending. Because if the courtyard is the whole world, you'll always be sweeping. So sweep as if you're awake. Sweep as if that's all you do. Sweep as if you're free in the sweeping. Sweep as if you're in love while you sweep. Be careful that you lose interest in the sense of obligation and duty and proving yourself and being the savior of the world, being the one who's responsible for the world, for everything. Meet what you can. Meet what's in front of you. Sweep. Meet the world. Take care of it. We can speak of ourselves as being distinct from others, but there's no hard line between self and others, me and you, us and them. In this world, we're all in it together. We are we. We're a we-ness. So we can say, you're we-ness. Instead of your highness. And I hope that you here spending the week at IRC, you could feel, could experience, get a taste for what it's like when we're a we. And the idea here is that we're trying to do here is to have a community where we're all in it together. We're all supporting each other, working together, doing it, practicing together. We're a we here. Every single person here is an important part of the community, makes it work. We're all practitioners. The teachers are practitioners. You're practitioners. You do yoga, you do the work meditation, the teachers do the work meditation. We're all kind of in it together. And I think it's a profound thing to have this kind of experience and to have a sense that our practice is done in a mutuality, that we are mutually benefiting each other. And to live a world of mutual benefit, not only benefiting others, but letting others benefit us. So we are we. And it's hard to do this abstractly, or it's all too easy to have this as an abstract idea. It's easy to love all beings in the abstract. I know I've sat on, especially some retreats where I slipped a little bit, occasionally, briefly maybe, into thinking. It might have happened. Maybe. And thinking about how I was going to be some equivalent of, you know, the Mother Teresa, or do some great thing. And, oh yes, I'm going to be able to love everyone, and it'll be so beatific and so wonderful, and I'll just be in a cloud. And that lasted until I stood in the meal line. So it's easy to do it abstractly sometimes, or it's hard to do it abstractly because it's not really real. But I think it's much more meaningful to discover how to do it in the immediacy of our lives, the immediacy of who we connect with and what we see, the immediacy of that contact in the particular person that we're with, that's in front of us. And then from there, maybe it grows and spreads. Or some real sense of being connected, rather than some dream or idea of what it is. And thinking about this today, I wanted to read a couple of quotes from Martin Luther King. All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated, that somehow we're caught in an incredible network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. So it points to the idea that, you know, it's not just about sitting in meditation to discover who you are, but we also discover who we are in relationship to each other. To find yourself is also to find yourself in that connection, and the mirroring, and the, what arises with us in the world of our relatedness. And then I like this quote a lot. And again, the idea that we're all together somehow. But that is, we may all have come on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. So being awake, trusting awareness, has less to do with doing than with letting go. We let go of things that hide the flame that's within us. And I like to believe that it's not so much we have to light the flame that's within, it's more like we have to take the covers off. The hindrances are the, remember I said I called them the coverings. Letting go. Letting go of how we suffer. Letting go of clinging, grasping, complaining, blaming, resenting. and holding on to being for and against things. It's okay to be for and against some things, but to hold on tight to it probably doesn't help. And as a society, we can't afford to be afraid. Or even in unintended ways, cause others to be afraid. So we can't afford to be afraid. That's a powerful statement, I think. I mean, most of us feel like I'm not making myself afraid. It's just there's dangerous things. It's completely reasonable to be afraid. Don't take it away from me. It's an important part of my life. How am I going to take care of myself if I'm not afraid? I think that fear is overrated for the most part. Especially if you understand that most people's fear has to do with anxiety or has to do with the imagination of things to come. But then there are people who live in real fear because there are real dangers they live in. There are people in our society who live in danger and fear and have been traumatized, who now are even more afraid than they were before because some of the, seemingly the very people who were the perpetrators of the trauma are the ones who are now coming into power. So it's, you know, it makes sense to be afraid. It makes sense to be afraid. But then we come back to the talk I gave the other day on strength. It's possible to become strong. It's possible to have a strength of confidence, of engagement, of attention, of focused work, of wisdom. It's possible to go into the dangers without feeling afraid. Some of this has to do with letting go. And I think that, I hope that, there are more and more people in our society who can step forward into the challenges we might face without their fear limiting them. Fear divides. Buddha says that fear is what is a source or a motivating force for violence. So part of the value of this practice we're doing here, mindfulness, is to really kind of really face our fear and really work with it and massage it and understand it. Some people, I give them the assignment to get a PhD in fear. Meaning you really need to get study this and understand your fear really well, just ins and outs and all its tricks and the way it works, so that you don't keep falling into that, sliding right back into it. Develop confidence, develop strength. To understand, I think one of the things being awake does, that freedom does, is we can really understand how little there is at stake for us personally. We can understand where that many of the things that we're trying to protect in ourselves maybe don't need to be protected because they can't be touched. They can't actually be harmed. That which is most essential in us cannot be harmed. And so to discover that place of awakeness, or the power of our intentions and our values, and inner freedom, power of compassion, stay close to that in such a way that it can't actually be harmed. And I think all of you have heard this amazing story of that old Tibetan teacher who was held in Chinese prisons for decades, finally somehow was able to release, and I guess he escaped to India, went to Dharamsala and had an audience with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama said, were you ever in danger? I don't know if he meant like for your life or something, because he was tortured. He wasn't just in jail, he was tortured and treated terribly. Were you ever in real danger? And the monk said, yes. I was in danger of losing my compassion for the Chinese, for the people who were torturing me. I think that's an amazing story. So where's the real danger? So what was he able to stay close to and trust? So this idea of lighting, trusting awareness, loving everyone, lighting the candle, or bring forth your candle, find your candle, your light, be a light unto yourself. The Buddha is not withdrawal, because the Buddha, after people were awakened in his time, he would tell them, go forth for the welfare of gods and humans. Go forth for the welfare of the world. And the question is, how do we go forth for the welfare of the world? Is there some way that's your way? You're your unique flower. You're a unique person. It doesn't have to look like anybody else's way. It doesn't have to be impressive. But what's your way of going forth with your candle? What's your way of sweeping? Of meeting the world. In the ancient Buddhism, the earliest forms of Buddhism, there's a very interesting teaching. That goes like this. If you want peace, be peaceful. If you want justice, be just. If you want understanding, search to understand. If you want to be understood by others, search to understand them. If you want love, love others. If you want safety, offer safety to others. The Buddha once said, make yourself a refuge for all beings. Make yourself a refuge for all beings. So, you'll be going back into your lives and I'm happy to report that nothing unusual happened this week that hasn't been happening for thousands of years. More of the same, so you didn't miss anything that... But it's possible when you're to live a life that's deliberate, that's purposeful. And it takes many ways, but this idea of a deliberate life, meaning life of choice, life you choose what you do, is a very powerful protection for your candle, for your light. It's a very powerful way of living. And it doesn't have to be big things, but it can be, for example, with reading the news. Some people, you know, going up to the election, or maybe now, and are checking the news regularly because it's so important. And all these, you know, alarm bells go off, and then you want to read again. We forget to breathe. And there's no oxygen and the candle goes out. There's no requirement to check the news all the time. to live a deliberate life is to have a deliberate choice about how you engage in the news. When, maybe even where, and how. I learned a long time ago, when I was living in the monastery, we would get the newspapers. They were always a few days late. And it was great to read old newspapers. I kind of was able to keep track of what was going on in the world, a little bit, you know. It wasn't up to date, but, you know, sometimes when I'm up to date, I forget a week later. So, but it was interesting to read it a few days later because it lost its urgency. And when it was fresh, it was like, you know, I can't believe this. But it's 2-3 days later, like, oh, you know, it's important to learn about it. So to be deliberate, you know, yes, it's good to be informed, but how are you being informed? And what effect does it have on you? To live a deliberate life is to choose and say, okay, I want to be a witness to what's happening. I don't want to ignore it. But I'm going to do it, read and study and learn in a way that keeps me awake, keeps me present, keeps me from losing myself. One thing I like to do is if I see there's something big going on in the news, there's some really good journalists who write, so it's good, you know, it's good writing. But I've noticed that there's a kind of a spin, and I get pulled into the spin, and something that has some kind of authority to it, and sometimes it's, you know, a certain leaning that's expressed in the writing. And so one thing I like to do is read the news on Wikipedia. Because Wikipedia, for some reason, some people are keeping it, some of the big news things are pretty up to date there, and they scan different news, and it's offered clinically or encyclopedically. And so it doesn't have the kind of extra little kind of excitement or urgency or, you know, voyeurism or alarm or whatever little kind of sense comes through sometimes in the writing. It's just like boom, 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 boom. It's like a list. And you get the bigger picture pretty quickly, and you get to know what's going on. And it kind of, I find that sometimes that's a kind of a much more easeful, relaxed way. It's possible that news is also biased, but at least that's a good way to begin. And so it's a way of this idea of being living deliberately, with choice of how you engage and what you do. I believe that a free life, a liberated life, an awake life, will live deliberately. Will not just kind of do things on a whim, will not just kind of coast along and just feel an urge to check the news, and I checked it 5 minutes ago, let me see if anything. Every time the computer pings for a new email, a liberated person doesn't like feel like, I have to check, gotta go see. But there's a deliberateness to, oh, this is not the time. I don't need to, no one's expecting me to be right on top of my emails every moment. I'll choose when I read my emails. And when I decide it's useful or appropriate, then I will. But I'm not going to be at the whim of the little ping on that the computer industry has added to the computer. So a deliberate life, a life of choice and care in how you live your life, so that awake people can be awake, so that you can make yourself a light and keep the light burning for others, so that you don't lose yourself in the world, don't lose yourself in your fear or your alarm or your anger or your desires, but you rather you settle back and trust awareness. Deliberately trust the life that flows through you, comes out of you, when you rest in awareness, when you rest in non-clinging, when you're okay with not holding on to anything, to deliberate, you say, this is where I'd like to be. And then as we do this, it's pretty natural, I believe it's pretty natural to want to start sweeping. And I really, it would be lovely if you had really good brooms. So you might want to give some thought to what your broom is, so that when the sweeping starts, that you're prepared. Sit and sweep. Trust awareness and love everyone. May you spend maybe these next few hours in the retreat giving you some reflection to these ideas, some reflection to how you want to live, the choices you want to make, the deliberateness that you want to live by, the values, the connection, what you'd like this retreat maybe to, how what you'd like to come out of this retreat so that it's a little more conscious and reflective about what this is about. And it's important to do this because it can be important. You don't have to, but if you do it, because many times people on retreat are attached to the experiences they have on the retreat, the calm and the openness and intimacy, and you know, they feel so good and peaceful or calm or so, I don't know what they do, you know, whatever. It's kind of, you know, the all this funny stuff that goes on. But that stuff goes. Sooner or later it goes away. Any experience you have will go away. So if you think the retreat's about an experience, it might not sustain you for long. But it's about what you've learned and the choices you want to make and decisions about how you want to move into this world, how you want to live. That might support you. The intentions you live by might support you and hopefully will help you wake up more often. May each of you, may each of your candles shine bright for all the rest of us.